fire. She silenced my protests with a look. I know he's not just any vampire. Even so, Matthew could kill you. And Sarah's devastated that she can't teach you how to control your talents. Sarah shouldn't worry about me. Did you see what I did to Juliet? She nodded. And other things as well. My grandmother's attention was now fixed on me instead of the paneling. I saw the hunger in Matthew when he fed on you, Em continued quietly. I saw the maiden and the crone, too, standing on the other side of the fire. Did Sarah see them? I whispered, hoping that Miriam couldn't hear. Em shook her head. No. Does Matthew know? No. I pushed my hair aside, relieved that Sarah was unaware of all that had happened last night. What did you promise the goddess in exchange for his life, Diana? Anything she wanted?
Oh, honey.
Em's face crumpled. You shouldn't have done that. There's no telling when she'll act, or what she'll take. My grandmother was furiously rocking. Em eyed the chair's wild movements. I had to, Em. The goddess didn't seem surprised. It felt inevitable. Right, somehow. Have you seen the maiden and the crone before? I nodded. The maiden's been in my dreams. Sometimes it's as though I'm inside her, looking out as she rides or hunts, and the crone met me outside the keeping room.
You're in deep water now, Diana, my grandmother rustled. I hope you can swim.
You mustn't call the goddess lightly, Em warned. These are powerful forces that you don't yet understand. I didn't call her at all. They appeared when I decided to give Matthew my blood. They gave me their help willingly.
Maybe it wasn't your blood to give.
My grandmother continued to rock back and forth, setting the floorboards creaking. Did you ever think of that? You've known Matthew for a few weeks, yet you follow his orders so easily and you were willing to die for him. Surely you can see why Sarah is concerned. The Diana we've known all these years is gone. I love him, I said fiercely, and he loves me. Matthew's many secrets, the Knights of Lazarus, Juliet, even Marcus, I pushed to the side, along with my knowledge of his ferocious temper and his need to control everything and everyone around him. But Em knew what I was thinking. She shook her head. You can't ignore them, Diana. You tried that with your magic and it found you. The parts of Matthew you don't like and don't understand are going to find you too. You can't hide forever, especially now. What do you mean? There are too many creatures interested in this manuscript, and in you and Matthew. I can feel them pressing in on the Bishop House, on you. I don't know which side of this struggle they're on, but my sixth sense tells me it won't be long before we find out. Em tucked the quilt around me. After putting another log on the fire, she left the room. I was awakened by my husband's distinctive spicy scent. You're back, I said, rubbing my eyes. Matthew looked rested, and his skin had returned to its normal, pearly color. He'd fed on human blood. So are you. Matthew brought my hand to his lips. Miriam said you've been sleeping for most of the day.
Is Sarah home?
Everyone's present and accounted for. He gave me a lopsided grin, even Tabitha. I asked to see them, and he unhooked me from my IV without argument. When my legs were too unsteady to carry me to the family room, he simply swept me up and carried me. Em and Marcus settled me into the sofa with great ceremony. I was quickly exhausted by nothing more strenuous than quiet conversation and watching the latest film noir selection on TV, and Matthew lifted me up once more. "We're going upstairs," he announced. "We'll see you in the morning."
"Do you want me to bring up Diana's IV?" Miriam asked pointedly.
"No, she doesn't need it." His voice was brusque. Thank you for not hooking me up to all that stuff, I said as he carried me through the front hall. Your body is still weak, but it's remarkably resilient for a warm blood, Matthew said as he climbed the stairs. The reward for being a perpetual motion machine, I imagine. Once he'd turned off the light, I curled into his body with a contented sigh, my fingers splayed possessively across his chest.
The moonlight streaming through the windows highlighted his new scars. They were already fading from pink to white. Tired as I was, the gears of Matthew's mind were working so furiously that sleep proved impossible. It was plain from the set of his mouth and the bright glitter of his eyes that he was picking our road forward, just as he'd promised to do last night. "Tell me," I said when the suspense became unbearable. "What we need is time," he said thoughtfully. "The congregation isn't likely to give us that." "We'll take it, then." His voice was almost inaudible. "We'll time walk." Chapter 39. We made it only halfway down the stairs the next morning before stopping to rest, but I was determined to get to the kitchen under my own steam. To my surprise, Matthew didn't try to dissuade me. We sat on the worn wooden treads in companionable silence. Pale, watery light seeped in through the wavy glass panes around the front door, hinting at a sunny day to come. From the family room came the click of Scrabble tiles. "When will you tell them?" There wasn't much to divulge yet. He was still working on the basic outlines of the plan. "Later," he said, leaning into me. I leaned toward him, pressing our shoulders closer. "No amount of coffee is going to keep Sarah from freaking out when she hears." I put my hand on the banister and levered myself to my feet with a sigh. "Let's try this again." In the family room, Em brought me my first cup of tea. I sipped it on the couch while Matthew and Marcus headed off for their walk with my silent blessing. They should spend as much time as possible together before we left. After my tea, Sarah made me her famous scrambled eggs. They were laden with onions, mushrooms, and cheese and topped with a spoonful of salsa. She put a steaming plate before me. "Thanks, Sarah." I dove in without further ceremony. "It's not just Matthew who needs food and rest." She glanced out the window to the orchard where the two vampires were walking. "I feel much better today," I said, crunching a bite of toast. "Your appetite seems to have recovered, at least." There was already a sizable dent in the mountain of eggs. When Matthew and Marcus returned, I was on my second plate of food. They both appeared grim, but Matthew shook his head at my curious look. Apparently, they hadn't been talking about our plans to time walk. Something else had put them into a sour mood. Matthew pulled up a stool, flapped open the paper, and concentrated on the news. I ate my eggs and toast, made more tea, and bided my time while Sarah washed and put away the dishes. At last, Matthew folded his paper and set it aside. "I'd like to go to the woods, to where Juliet died," I announced. He got to his feet. "I'll pull the Range Rover to the door." "This is madness, Matthew. It's too soon." Marcus turned to Sarah for support. "Let them go," Sarah said. "Diana should put on warmer clothes first, though. It's chilly outside." Em appeared, a puzzled expression on her face. "Are we expecting visitors? The house thinks we are." "You're joking," I said. "The house hasn't added a room since the last family reunion. Where is it?" "Between the bathroom and the junk room." Em pointed at the ceiling. "I told you this wasn't just about you and Matthew," she said silently to me as we trooped upstairs to view the transformation. "My premonitions are seldom wrong." The newly materialized room held an ancient brass bed with enormous polished balls capping each corner, tatty red gingham curtains that Em insisted were coming down immediately, a hooked rug in clashing shades of maroon and plum, and a battered washstand with a chipped pink bowl and pitcher. None of us recognized a single item. "Where did it all come from?" Miriam asked in amazement. "Who knows where the house keeps this stuff?" Sarah sat on the bed and bounced on it vigorously. It responded with a series of outraged squeaks. "The house's most legendary feats happened around my 13th birthday," I remembered with a grin. "It came up with a record 4 bedrooms and a Victorian parlor set."
"And 24 place settings of blue willow china," Em recalled. "We've still got some of the teacups, although most of the bigger pieces disappeared again once the family left."
After everybody had inspected the new room and the now considerably smaller storage room next door, I changed and made my halting way downstairs and into the Range Rover. When we drew close to the spot where Juliet had met her end, Matthew stopped. The heavy tires sank into the soft ground. Shall we walk the rest of the way? He suggested. We can take it slowly. He was different this morning. He wasn't coddling me or telling me what to do.
What's changed?
I asked as we approached the ancient oak tree. I've seen you fight, he said quietly. On the battlefield, the bravest men collapse in fear. They simply can't fight, even to save themselves.
But I froze.
My hair tumbled forward to conceal my face. Matthew stopped in his tracks, his fingers tightening on my arm to make me stop too.
Of course you did. You were about to take a life, but you don't fear death.
No.
I'd lived with death, sometimes longed for it, since I was 7. He swung me around to face him. After La Pierre, Sartu left you broken and uncertain. All your life you've hidden from your fears. I wasn't sure you'd be able to fight if you had to. Now all I have to do is keep you from taking unnecessary risks. His eyes drifted to my neck. Matthew moved forward, towing me gently along. A smudge of blackened grass told me we'd arrived at the clearing. I stiffened, and he released my arm. The marks left by the fire led to the dead patch where Juliet had fallen. The forest was eerily quiet, without bird calls or other sounds of life. I gathered a bit of charred wood from the ground. It crumbled to soot in my fingers. I didn't know Juliet, but at that moment I hated her enough to kill her. Her brown and green eyes would always haunt me from shadows under the trees. I traced the line left by the arc of conjured fire to where the maiden and the crone had agreed to help me save Matthew. I looked up into the oak tree and gasped. It began yesterday. Matthew followed my gaze. Sarah says you pulled the life out of it. Above me, the branches of the tree were cracked and withered. Bare limbs forked and forked again into shapes reminiscent of a stag's horns. Brown leaves swirled at my feet. Matthew had survived because I'd pushed its vitality through my veins and into his body. The oak's rough bark had exuded such permanence, yet there was nothing now but hollowness.
Power always exacts a price, Matthew said.
What have I done?
The death of a tree was not going to settle my debt to the goddess. For the first time, I was afraid of the deal I'd struck. Matthew crossed the clearing and caught me up in his arms. We hugged each other, fierce with the knowledge of all we'd almost lost. You promised me you would be less reckless. There was anger in his voice. I was angry with him, too. You were supposed to be indestructible. He rested his forehead against mine.
I should have told you about Juliet.
Yes, you should have. She almost took you from me.
My pulse throbbed behind the bandage on my neck. Matthew's thumb settled against the spot where he'd bitten through flesh and muscle, his touch unexpectedly warm.
It was far too close.
His fingers were wrapped in my hair and his mouth was hard on mine. Then we stood, hearts pressed together, in the quiet.
When I took Juliet's life, it made her part of mine, forever.
Matthew stroked my hair against my skull. Death is its own powerful magic. Calm again, I said a silent word of thanks to the goddess, not only for Matthew's life, but for my own. We walked toward the Range Rover, but halfway there I stumbled with fatigue. Matthew swung me onto his back and carried me the rest of the way. Sarah was bent over her desk in the office when we arrived at the house. She flew outside and pulled open the car door with speed a vampire might envy. "Damn it, Matthew," she said, looking at my exhausted face. Together they got me inside and back onto the family room couch, where I rested my head in Matthew's lap. I was lulled to sleep by the quiet sounds of activity all around, and the last thing I remembered clearly was the smell of vanilla and the sound of M's battered KitchenAid mixer. Matthew woke me for lunch, which turned out to be vegetable soup. The look on his face suggested that I would shortly need sustenance. He was about to tell our families of the plan.
"Ready, mon coeur?" Matthew asked.
I nodded, scraping up the last of my meal. Marcus's head swiveled in our direction.
"We have something to share with you," he announced.
The new household tradition was to proceed to the dining room whenever something important needed to be discussed. Once we were assembled, all eyes turned to Matthew.
"What have you decided?" Marcus asked without preamble.
Matthew took a deliberate breath and began.
We need to go where it won't be easy for the congregation to follow, where Diana will have time and teachers who can help her master her magic.
Sarah laughed under her breath. Where is this place, where there are powerful, patient witches who don't mind having a vampire hanging around?
It's not a particular place I have in mind, Matthew said cryptically. We're going to hide Diana in time.
Everyone started shouting at once. Matthew took my hand in his.
Courage, I murmured in French, repeating his advice when I met Isabeau.
He snorted and gave me a grim smile.
I had some sympathy for their amazed disbelief. Last night, while I was lying in bed, my own reaction had been much the same. First, I'd insisted that it was impossible, and then I'd asked for 1,000 details about precisely when and where we were going. He'd explained what he could, which wasn't much. You want to use your magic, but now it's using you. You need a teacher, one who is more adept than Sarah or Emily. It's not their fault they can't help you. Witches in the past were different. So much of their knowledge has been lost.
Where?
When? I'd whispered in the dark. Nothing too distant, though the most recent past has its own risks, but back far enough that we'll find a witch to train you. First, we have to talk to Sarah about whether it can be done safely, and then we need to locate 3 items to steer us to the right time.
We? I'd asked in surprise. Won't I just meet you there?
Not unless there's no alternative. I wasn't the same creature then, and I wouldn't entirely trust my past selves with you.
His mouth softened in relief after I nodded in agreement. A few days ago, he'd rejected the idea of time-walking. Apparently, the risks of staying put were even worse.
What will the others do?
His thumb traveled slowly over the veins on the back of my hand. Miriam and Marcus will go back to Oxford. The congregation will look for you here first. It would be best if Sarah and Emily went away, at least for a little while. Would they go to Isabeau? Matthew wondered.
On the surface, it had sounded like a ridiculous idea. Sarah and Isabeau under the same roof? The more I considered it, though, the less implausible it seemed.
I don't know, I'd mused. Then a new worry had surfaced. Marcus.
I didn't fully understand the intricacies of the Knights of Lazarus, but with Matthew gone, he would have to shoulder even more responsibility.
There's no other way, Matthew had said in the darkness, quieting me with a kiss. This was precisely the point that M now wanted to argue.
There must be another way, she protested.
I tried to think of one, Emily, Matthew said apologetically.
Where, or should I say when, are you planning on going? Diana won't exactly blend into the background, she's too tall.
Miriam looked down at her own tiny hands.
Regardless of whether Diana could fit in, it's too dangerous, Marcus said firmly. You might end up in the middle of a war, or an epidemic.
Or a witch hunt.
Miriam didn't say it maliciously, but 3 heads swung around in indignation nonetheless.
Sarah, what do you think? Asked Matthew.
Of all the creatures in the room, she was the calmest.
You'll take her to a time when she'll be with witches who will help her?
Yes. Sarah closed her eyes for a moment, then opened them.
You two aren't safe here. Juliet Durand proved that, and if you aren't safe in Madison, you aren't safe anywhere.
Thank you. Matthew opened his mouth to say something else, and Sarah held up her hand.
Don't promise me anything, she said, voice tight. You'll be careful for her sake, if not for your own.
Now all we have to worry about is the time-walking. Matthew turned businesslike. Diana will need 3 items from a particular time and place in order to move safely. Sarah nodded. Do I count as a thing? He asked her.
Do you have a pulse? Of course you're not a thing.
It was one of the most positive statements Sarah had ever made about vampires.
If you need old stuff to guide your way, you're welcome to these.
Marcus pulled a thin leather cord from the neck of his shirt and lifted it over his head. It was festooned with a bizarre assortment of items, including a tooth, a coin, a lump of something that shone black and gold, and a battered silver whistle. He tossed it to Matthew.
"Didn't you get this off a yellow fever victim?" Matthew asked, fingering the tooth.
"In New Orleans," Marcus replied, "the epidemic of 1819."
"New Orleans is out of the question," Matthew said sharply.
"I suppose so."
Marcus slid a glance my way, then returned his attention to his father. "How about Paris? One of Fanny's earbobs is on there."
Matthew's fingers touched the tiny red stone set in gold filigree.
Philippe and I sent you away from Paris, and Fanny too. They called it the Terror, remember? It's no place for Diana.
The two of you fussed over me like old women. I'd been in one revolution already. Besides, if you're looking for a safe place in the past, you'll have a hell of a time finding one, Marcus grumbled. His face brightened.
Philadelphia?
I wasn't in Philadelphia with you or in California, Matthew said hastily before his son could speak. It would be best if we head for a time and place I know.
Even if you know where we're going, Matthew, I'm not sure I can pull this off. My decision to stay clear of magic had caught up with me again.
I think you can, Sarah said bluntly. You've been doing it your whole life. When you were a baby, as a child when you played hide-and-seek with Stephen, and as an adolescent, too. Remember all those mornings we dragged you out of the woods and had to clean you up in time for school? What do you imagine you were doing then?
Certainly not time-walking, I said truthfully. The science of this still worries me. Where does this body go when I'm somewhere else?
Who knows? But don't worry, it's happened to everybody. You drive to work and don't remember how you got there. Or the whole afternoon passes and you don't have a clue what you did. Whenever something like that happens, you can bet there's a time walker nearby, explained Sarah. She was remarkably unfazed at the prospect.
Matthew sensed my apprehension and took my hand in his.
Einstein said that all physicists were aware that the distinctions between past, present, and future were only what he called a stubbornly persistent illusion. Not only did he believe in marvels and wonders, he also believed in the elasticity of time.
There was a tentative knock at the door.
I didn't hear a car, Miriam said warily, rising to her feet. It's just Sammy collecting the newspaper money.
Em slid from her chair.
We waited silently while she crossed the hall, the floorboards protesting under her feet. From the way their hands were pressed flat against the table's wooden surface, Matthew and Marcus were both ready to fly to the door, too. Cold air swept into the dining room.
Yes?
Em asked in a puzzled voice. In an instant, Marcus and Matthew rose and joined her, accompanied by Tabitha, who was intent on supporting the leader of the pack in his important business.
Not the paper boy, Sarah said unnecessarily, looking at the empty chair next to me.
Are you Diana Bishop?
Asked a deep male voice, with the familiar foreign accent of flat vowels accompanied by a slight drawl.
No, I'm her aunt, Em replied.
Is there something we can do for you?
Matthew sounded cold, though polite.
My name is Nathaniel Wilson, and this is my wife, Sophie. We were told we might find Diana Bishop here.
Who told you that? Matthew asked softly.
His mother, Agatha.
I stood, moving to the door.
His voice reminded me of the demon from Blackwell's, the fashion designer from Australia with the beautiful brown eyes. Miriam tried to bar my way into the hall, but stepped aside when she saw my expression. Marcus was not so easily dealt with. He grabbed my arm and held me in the shadows by the staircase. Nathaniel's eyes nudged gently against my face. He was in his early 20s and had familiar fair hair and chocolate-colored eyes, as well as his mother's wide mouth and fine features. Where Agatha had been compact and trim, however, he was nearly as tall as Matthew, with the broad shoulders and narrow hips of a swimmer. An enormous backpack was slung over one shoulder.
"Are you Diana Bishop?" he asked. A woman's face peeped out from Nathaniel's side. It was sweet and round, with intelligent brown eyes and a dimpled chin. She was in her early 20s as well, and the gentle, insidious pressure of her glance indicated that she too was a demon. As she studied me, a long brown braid tumbled over her shoulder.
"That's her," the young woman said, her soft accent betraying that she was born in the South. "She looks just like she did in my dreams."
"It's all right, Matthew," I said. These two demons posed no more danger to me than did Mart or Isabeau.
"So, you're the vampire," Nathaniel said, giving Matthew an appraising look. "My mother warned me about you." "You should listen to her," Matthew suggested, his voice dangerously soft. Nathaniel seemed unimpressed. "She told me you wouldn't welcome the son of a congregation member, but I'm not here on their behalf. I'm here because of Sophie." He drew his wife under his arm in a protective gesture, and she shivered and crept closer. Neither was dressed for autumn in New York. Nathaniel was wearing an old barn jacket, and Sophie had on nothing warmer than a turtleneck and a hand-knit cardigan that brushed her knees.
Are they both demons? Matthew asked me.
Yes, I replied, though something made me hesitate.
Are you a vampire as well? Nathaniel asked Marcus. Marcus gave him a wolfish grin. Guilty.
Sophie was still nudging me with her characteristic demonic glance, but there was the faintest tingle on my skin. Her hand crept possessively around her belly. You're pregnant, I cried.
Marcus was so surprised that he loosened his grip on me. Matthew caught me as I went by. The house, agitated by the appearance of two visitors and Matthew's sudden lunge, made its displeasure clear by banging the keeping room's doors tightly closed.
What you feel, it's me, Sophie said, moving an inch closer to her husband. My people were witches, but I came out wrong.
Sarah came into the hall, saw the visitors, and threw up her hands. Here we go again. I told you demons would be showing up in Madison before long. Still, the house usually knows our business better than we do. Now that you're here, you might as well come inside out of the cold. The house groaned as if it were heartily sick of us when the demons entered. Don't worry, I said, trying to reassure them. The house told us you were coming, no matter what it sounds like.
My granny's house was just the same, Sophie smiled. She lived in the old Norman place in Seven Devils. That's where I'm from. It's officially part of North Carolina, but my dad said that nobody bothered to tell folks in town. We're kind of a nation unto ourselves. The keeping room doors opened wide, revealing my grandmother and three or four more bishops, all of whom were watching the proceedings with interest. The boy with the berry basket waved. Sophie shyly waved back. Granny had ghosts, too, she said calmly. The ghosts, combined with two unfriendly vampires and an overly expressive house, were too much for Nathaniel. We aren't staying longer than we have to, Sophie. You came to give something to Diana. Let's get it over with and be on our way, Nathaniel said. Miriam chose that minute to step out of the shadows by the dining room, her arms crossed over her chest. Nathaniel took a step backward. First vampires, now demons. What's next? Sarah muttered. She turned to Sophie. So you're about 5 months along? The baby quickened last week, Sophie replied, both hands resting on her belly. That's when Agatha told us we could find Diana. She didn't know about my family. I've been having dreams about you for months, and I don't know what Agatha saw that made her so scared.
What dreams? Matthew said, his voice quick. Let's have Sophie sit down before we subject her to an inquisition. Sarah quietly took charge.
Em, can you bring us some of those cookies? Milk, too?
Em headed toward the kitchen, where we could hear the distant clatter of glasses. They could be my dreams or they could be hers. Sophie gazed at her belly as Sarah led her and Nathaniel deeper into the house. She looked back over her shoulder at Matthew.
She's a witch, you see. That's probably what worried Nathaniel's mom.
All eyes dropped to the bump under Sophie's blue sweater. The dining room, Sarah said in a tone that brooked no nonsense. Everybody in the dining room.
Matthew held me back. There's something too convenient about us showing up right now. No mention of time walking in front of them.
They're harmless. Every instinct confirmed it.
Nobody's harmless, and that certainly goes for Agatha Wilson's son.
Tabitha, who was sitting next to Matthew, mewled in agreement.
Are you two joining us, or do I have to drag you into this room? Sarah called.
We're on our way, Matthew said smoothly.
Sarah was at the head of the table. She pointed at the empty chairs to her right. Sit.
We were facing Sophie and Nathaniel, who sat with an empty seat between them and Marcus. Matthew's son split his attention between his father and the demons. I sat between Matthew and Miriam, both of whom never took their eyes from Nathaniel. When Em entered, she had a tray laden with wine, milk, bowls of berries and nuts, and an enormous plate of cookies.
God, cookies make me wish like hell I was still warm-blooded, Marcus said reverently, picking up one of the golden discs studded with chocolate and holding it to his nose. They smell so good, but they taste terrible.
Have these instead, Em said, sliding him a bowl of walnuts. They're covered in vanilla and sugar.
They're not cookies, but they're close.
She passed him a bottle of wine and a corkscrew, too.
Open that and pour some for your father.
Thanks, Em, Marcus said around a mouthful of sticky walnuts, already pulling the cork free from the bottle. You're the best. Sarah watched intently as Sophie drank thirstily from the glass of milk and ate a cookie. When the demon reached for her second, my aunt turned to Nathaniel.
Now, where's your car?
Given all that had happened, it was an odd opening question.
We came on foot.
Nathaniel hadn't touched anything Em put in front of him.
From where?
Marcus asked incredulously, handing Matthew a glass of wine. He'd seen enough of the surrounding countryside to know that there was nothing within walking distance.
We rode with a friend from Durham to Washington, Sophie explained. Then we caught a train from D.C. to New York. I don't like the city much.
We caught the train to Albany and then went on to Syracuse. The bus took us to Casanova. Nathaniel put a warning hand on Sophie's arm.
He doesn't want me to tell you that we caught a ride from a stranger, Sophie confided with a smile. The lady knew where the house was. Her kids love coming here on Halloween because you're real witches.
Sophie took another sip of milk.
Not that we needed the directions. There's a lot of energy in this house. We couldn't have missed it.
Is there a reason you took such an indirect route? Matthew asked Nathaniel.
Somebody followed us as far as New York, but Sophie and I got back on the train for Washington and they lost interest. Nathaniel bristled.
Then we got off the train in New Jersey and went back to the city. The man in the station said tourists get confused all the time about which way the train is going. They didn't even charge us, did they, Nathaniel?
Sophie looked pleased at the warm reception they'd received from Amtrak. Matthew continued with his interrogation of Nathaniel. Where are you staying?
They're staying here.
Em's voice had a sharp edge.
They don't have a car, and the house made room for them. Besides, Sophie needs to talk to Diana. I'd like that. Agatha said you'd be able to help. Something about a book for the baby?
Sophie said softly. Marcus's eyes darted to the page from Ashmole 782, the edge of which was peeking from underneath the chart laying out the Knights of Lazarus's chain of command. He hastily drew the papers into a pile, moving an innocuous-looking set of DNA results to the top.
What book, Sophie? I asked. We didn't tell Agatha my people were witches. I didn't even tell Nathaniel, not until he came home to meet my dad. We'd been together for almost 4 years, and my dad was sick and losing control over his magic. I didn't want Nathaniel spooked. Anyway, when we got married, we thought it was best not to cause a fuss. Agatha was on the congregation by then, and was always talking about the segregation rules and what happened when folks broke 'em.
Sophie shook her head.
It never made any sense to me.
The book? I repeated, gently trying to steer the conversation.
Oh.
Sophie's forehead creased with concentration and she fell silent.
My mother is thrilled about the baby. She said it's going to be the best-dressed child the world has ever seen.
Nathaniel smiled tenderly at his wife.
Then the dream started. Sophie felt trouble was coming. She has strong premonitions for a demon, just like my mother. In September she started seeing Diana's face and hearing a name. Sophie said people want something from you.
Matthew's fingers touched the small of my back where Satu's scar dipped down.
Show them her face, Jug, Nathaniel. It's just a picture. I wanted to bring it, but he said we couldn't carry a gallon jug from Durham to New York.
Her husband obediently took out his phone and pulled up a picture on the screen. Nathaniel handed the phone to Sarah, who gasped.
I'm a potter, like my mama and her mother. Granny used witch fire in her kiln, but I just do it the ordinary way. All of the faces from my dreams go on my jugs. Not all of them are scary. Yours wasn't.
Sarah passed the phone to Matthew. It's beautiful, Sophie, he said sincerely. I had to agree. Its tall, rounded shape was pale gray, and two handles curved away from its narrow spout. On the front was a face. My face, though distorted by the jug's proportions. My chin jutted out from the surface, as did my nose, my ears, and the sweep of my brow bones. Thick squiggles of clay stood in for hair. My eyes were closed, and my mouth smiled serenely, as if I were keeping a secret.
This is for you, too.
Sophie drew a small, lumpy object out of the pocket of her cardigan. It was wrapped in oilcloth, secured with string.
When the baby quickened, I knew for sure it belonged to you. The baby knows, too. Maybe that's what made Agatha so worried. And of course we have to figure out what to do, since the baby's a witch. Nathaniel's mom thought you might have some ideas. We watched in silence while Sophie picked at the knots.
Sorry, she muttered. My dad tied it up. He was in the Navy.
Can I help you?
Marcus asked, reaching for the lump.
No, I've got it.
Sophie smiled at him sweetly and went back to her work.
It has to be wrapped up or it turns black, and it's not supposed to be black, it's supposed to be white.
Our collective curiosity was now thoroughly aroused, and there wasn't a sound in the house except for the lapping of Tabitha's tongue as she groomed her paws.
The string fell away, followed by the oilcloth.
There, Sophie whispered. I may not be a witch, but I'm the last of the Normans. We've been keeping this for you.
It was a small figurine, no more than 4 inches tall, and made from old silver that glowed with the softly burnished light seen in museum showcases. Sophie turned the figurine so that it faced me.
Diana, I said unnecessarily.
The goddess was represented exactly, from the tips of the crescent moon on her brow to her sandaled feet. She was in motion, one foot striding forward, while a hand reached over her shoulders to draw an arrow from her quiver. The other hand rested on the antlers of a stag.
Where did you get that?
Matthew sounded strange, and his face had gone gray again.
Sophie shrugged. Nobody knows. The Normans have always had it. It's been passed down in the family from witch to witch. When the time comes, give it to the one who has need of it. That's what my granny told my father, and my father told me. It used to be written on a little piece of paper, but that was lost a long time ago.
What is it, Matthew?
Marcus looked uneasy. So did Nathaniel.
It's a chess piece.
Matthew's voice broke. The White Queen.
How do you know that?
Sarah looked at the figurine critically.
It's not like any chess piece I ever saw.
Matthew had to force the words out from behind tight lips. Because it was once mine. My father gave it to me.
How did it end up in North Carolina?
I stretched my fingers toward the silver object, and the figurine slid across the table as if it wanted to be in my possession. The stag's antlers cut into my palm as my hand closed around it, the metal quickly warming to my touch.
I lost it in a wager, Matthew said quietly. I've no idea how it got to North Carolina.
He buried his face in his hands and murmured a single word that made no sense to me.
Kit.
Do you remember when you last had it? Sarah asked sharply.
I remember precisely.
Matthew lifted his head.
I was playing a game with it many years ago, on All Souls Night. It was then that I lost my wager.
That's next week.
Miriam shifted in her seat so that she could meet Sarah's eyes. Would time-walking be easier around the feasts of All Saints and All Souls?
Miriam, Matthew snarled, but it was too late.
What's time-walking? Nathaniel whispered to Sophie.
Mama was a time walker, Sophie whispered back. She was good at it, too, and always came back from the 1700s with lots of ideas for pots and jugs.
Your mother visited the past? Nathaniel asked faintly. He looked around the room at the motley assortment of creatures, then at his wife's belly.
Does that run in witches' families, too, like second sight?
Sarah answered Miriam over the demon's whispered conversation. There's not much keeping the living from the dead between Halloween and All Souls. It would be easier to slip between the past and the present then. Nathaniel looked more anxious. The living and the dead? Sophie and I just came to deliver that statue, or whatever it is, so she can sleep through the night.
Will Diana be strong enough? Marcus asked Matthew, ignoring Nathaniel.
This time of year, it should be much easier for Diana to time walk, Sarah mused aloud. Sophie looked contentedly around the table.
This reminds me of the old days when Granny and her sisters got together and gossiped. They never seemed to pay attention to one another, but they always knew what had been said.
The room's many competing conversations stopped abruptly when the dining room doors banged open and shut, followed by a booming sound produced by the heavier keeping room doors. Nathaniel, Miriam, and Marcus shot to their feet.
What the hell was that? Marcus asked.
The house, I said wearily. I'll go see what it wants.
Matthew scooped up the figurine and followed me.
The old woman with the embroidered bodice was waiting at the keeping room's threshold.
Hello, ma'am.
Sophie had followed right behind and was nodding politely to the old woman. She scrutinized my features.
The lady looks a bit like you, doesn't she?
So you've chosen your road, the old woman said.
Her voice was fainter than before.
We have, I said.
Footsteps sounded behind me as the remaining occupants of the dining room came to see what the commotion was about.
You'll be needing something else for your journey, she replied.
The coffin doors swung open, and the press of creatures at my back was matched by the crowd of ghosts waiting by the fireplace.
This should be interesting, my grandmother said dryly from her place at the head of the ghostly bunch.
There was a rumbling in the walls, like bones rattling. I sat in my grandmother's rocker,
my knees no longer able to hold my weight. A crack developed in the paneling between the window and the fireplace. It stretched and widened into a diagonal slash. The old wood shuddered and squeaked. Something soft with legs and arms flew out of the gap. I flinched when it landed in my lap.
"Holy shit," Sarah said. "That paneling will never look the same," my grandmother commented, shaking her head regretfully at the cracked wood.
Whatever flew at me was made of rough-spun fabric that had faded to an indiscriminate grayish-brown. In addition to its four limbs, it had a lump where the head belonged, adorned with faded tufts of hair. Someone had stitched an X where the heart should be.
"What is it?"
I reached my index finger toward the uneven, rusty stitches.
"Don't touch it," Em cried.
"I'm already touching it," I said, looking up in confusion. "It's sitting on my lap."
"I've never seen such an old poppet," said Sophie, peering down at it.
"Poppet?"
Miriam frowned.
"Didn't one of your ancestors get into trouble over a poppet?"
"Bridget Bishop," Sarah, Em, and I said the name at the same moment. The old woman with the embroidered bodice was now standing next to my grandmother.
"Is this yours?" I whispered.
A smile turned up one corner of Bridget's mouth.
"Remember to be canny when you find yourself at a crossroads, daughter. There's no telling what secrets are buried there."
Looking down at the poppet, I lightly touched the X on its chest. The fabric split open, revealing a stuffing made of leaves, twigs, and dried flowers, and releasing the scent of herbs into the air.
"Rue," I said, recognizing it from Mart's tea.
"Clover, broom, knotweed, and slippery elm bark, too, from the smell of it." Sarah gave the air a good sniff. "That poppet was made to draw someone. Diana, presumably, but it's got a protection spell on it, too."
"You did well by her," Bridget told my grandmother with an approving nod at Sarah.
Something was gleaming through the brown. When I pulled at it gently, the poppet came apart in pieces.
"And there's an end to it," Bridget said with a sigh.
My grandmother put a comforting arm around her.
"It's an earring."
Its intricate golden surfaces caught the light, and an enormous teardrop-shaped pearl shone at the end.
"How the hell did one of my mother's earrings get into Bridget Bishop's poppet?"
Matthew's face was back to that pasty gray color.
"Were your mother's earrings in the same place as your chess set on that long-ago night?" Miriam asked.
Both the earrings and the chess piece were old, older than the poppet, older than the Bishop house. Matthew thought a moment, then nodded.
"Yes. Is a week enough time? Can you be ready?" he asked me urgently.
"I don't know." "Sure you'll be ready," Sophie crooned to her belly. "She'll make things right for you, little witch. You'll be her godmother," Sophie said with a radiant smile. "She'll like that."
"Counting the baby, and not counting the ghosts, of course," Marcus said in a deceptively conversational tone that reminded me of the way Matthew spoke when he was stressed. "There are 9 of us in this room."
4 witches, 3 vampires, and 2 demons," Sophie said dreamily, her hand still on her belly. "But we're short a demon. Without one, we can't be a conventicle. And once Matthew and Diana leave, we'll need another vampire, too. Is Matthew's mother still alive?"
"She's tired," Nathaniel said apologetically, his hands tightening on his wife's shoulders. "It makes it difficult for her to focus."
"What did you say?"
Em asked Sophie. She was struggling to keep her voice calm. Sophie's eyes lost their dreaminess.
"A conventicle? That's what they called a gathering of dissenters in the old days. Ask them."
She inclined her head in the direction of Marcus and Miriam.
"I told you this wasn't about the bishops or the de Clermonts,"
Em said to Sarah.
"It's not even about Matthew and Diana and whether they can be together. It's about Sophie and Nathaniel, too. It's about the future, just as Diana said. This is how we'll fight the congregation, not just as individual families, but as a... what did you call it?"
"Conventicle," Miriam answered. "I always liked that word. So delightfully ominous."
She settled back on her heels with a satisfied smile. Matthew turned to Nathaniel.
"It would seem your mother was right. You do belong here with us."
"Of course they belong here," Sarah said briskly. "Your bedroom is ready, Nathaniel. It's upstairs, the second door to the right."
"Thank you,"
Nathaniel said, a note of cautious relief in his voice, though he still eyed Matthew warily.
I'm Marcus. Matthew's son held out his hand to the demon. Nathaniel clasped it firmly, barely reacting to the shocking coldness of vampire flesh.
See, we didn't need to make reservations at that hotel, sweetie,
Sophie told her husband with a beatific smile. She looked for Em in the crowd.
Are there more cookies?
Chapter 40. A few days later, Sophie was sitting at the kitchen island with half a dozen pumpkins and a sharp knife when Matthew and I came in from our walk. The weather had turned colder, and there was a dreary hint of winter in the air.
What do you think?
Sophie asked, turning to the pumpkin.
It had the hollow eyes, arched eyebrows, and gaping mouth of all Halloween pumpkins, but she'd transformed the usual features into something remarkable. Lines pulled away from the mouth, and the forehead was creased, setting the eyes themselves slightly off-kilter. The overall effect was chilling.
Amazing.
Matthew looked at the pumpkin with delight. She bit her lip, regarding her work critically.
I'm not sure the eyes are right.
I laughed. At least it has eyes. Sometimes Sarah can't be bothered and just pokes 3 round holes in the side with the end of a screwdriver and calls it a day. Halloween is a busy holiday for witches. We don't always have time for the finer details, Sarah said sharply, coming out of the still room to inspect Sophie's work. She nodded with approval. But this year will be the envy of the neighborhood. Sophie smiled shyly and pulled another pumpkin toward her.
I'll do a less scary one next. We don't want to make the little kids cry.
With less than a week to go until Halloween, Em and Sarah were in a flurry of activity to get ready for the Madison Coven's annual fall bash. There would be food, free-flowing drink, including Em's famous punch, which had at least one July birth to its credit, and enough witchy activities to keep the Sugar High children occupied and away from the bonfire after they'd been trick-or-treating. Bobbing for apples was much more challenging when the fruit in question had been put under a spell. My aunts hinted that they would cancel their plans, but Matthew just shook his head.
Everyone in town would wonder if you didn't show up. This is just a typical Halloween.
We all looked dubious. After all, Sarah and Em weren't the only ones counting the hours to Halloween.
Last night, Matthew had laid out the gradual departure of everyone in the house, starting with Nathaniel and Sophie and ending with Marcus and Miriam. It would, he believed, make our own departure less conspicuous. And it was not open to discussion. Marcus and Nathaniel had exchanged a long look when Matthew finished his announcement, which concluded with the demon shaking his head and pressing his lips together, and the younger vampire staring fixedly at the table while a muscle in his jaw throbbed.
"But who will hand out the candy?" Em asked.
Matthew looked thoughtful.
"Diana and I will do it."
The two young men had stormed out of the room when we broke up to go our separate ways, mumbling something about getting milk. Then they'd climbed into Marcus's car and torn down the driveway.
"You've got to stop telling them what to do," I chided Matthew, who had joined me at the front door to watch their departure. "They're both grown men. Nathaniel has a wife and soon he'll have a child."
Left to their own devices, Marcus and Nathaniel would have an army of vampires on the doorstep tomorrow.
"You won't be here to order them around next week," I reminded him, watching the taillights as they turned toward town. "Your son will be in charge."
"That's what I'm worried about."
The real problem was that we were in the midst of an acute outbreak of testosterone poisoning. Nathaniel and Matthew couldn't be in the same room without sparks flying, and in the increasingly crowded house, it was hard for them to avoid each other. Their next argument occurred that afternoon when a delivery arrived. It was a box with "Biohazard" written all over the sealing tape in large red letters.
"What the hell is this?" Marcus asked, carrying the box gingerly into the family room.
Nathaniel looked up from his laptop, his brown eyes widening with alarm.
"That's for me,"
Matthew said smoothly, taking the box from his son.
"My wife is pregnant," Nathaniel said furiously, snapping his laptop closed. "How could you bring that into the house?"
"It's immunizations for Diana." Matthew barely kept his annoyance in check.
I put aside my magazine. "What immunizations?"
"You're not going to the past without every possible protection from disease. Come to the still room,"
Matthew said, holding out his hand.
"Tell me what's in the box first."
"Booster vaccines. Tetanus, typhoid, polio, diphtheria, as well as some vaccines you probably haven't had, like a new one-shot rabies preventative, the latest flu shots, and immunization for cholera." He paused, still holding out his hand. And a smallpox vaccine.
Smallpox?
They'd stopped giving smallpox vaccines to school children a few years before I was born. That meant Sophie and Nathaniel hadn't been immunized either. Matthew reached down and hoisted me to my feet.
Let's get started, he said firmly.
You aren't going to stick needles into me today.
Better needles today than smallpox and lockjaw tomorrow, he countered.
Wait a minute. Nathaniel's voice sounded in the room like a cracking whip. The smallpox vaccine makes you contagious. What about Sophie and the baby?
Explain it to him, Marcus, Matthew ordered, stepping aside so I could pass.
Not contagious with smallpox exactly, Marcus tried to be reassuring. It's a different strain of the disease. Sophie will be fine, provided she doesn't touch Diana's arm or anything it comes into contact with.
Sophie smiled at Marcus.
Okay, I can do that.
Do you always do everything he tells you to do?
Nathaniel asked Marcus with contempt, unfolding from the couch. He looked down at his wife.
Sophie, we're leaving.
Stop fussing, Nathaniel, Sophie said. You'll upset the house, the baby, too, if you start talking about leaving. We're not going anywhere.
Nathaniel gave Matthew an evil look and sat down.
In the still room, Matthew had me take off my sweatshirt and turtleneck and then began swabbing my left arm with alcohol. The door creaked open. It was Sarah. She'd stood by without comment during the exchange between Matthew and Nathaniel, though her eyes had seldom left the newly delivered box.
Matthew had already sliced open the protective tape, wrapped around the molded foam container.
7 small vials were nestled within, along with a bag of pills, something that looked like a container of salt, and a 2-pronged metal instrument I'd never seen before. He'd already entered the same state of clinical detachment I'd first detected in his lab in Oxford, with no time for chatter or a warm bedside manner. Sarah was welcome moral support.
"I've got some old white shirts for you to wear." Sarah momentarily distracted me from what Matthew was doing.
"They'll be easy to bleach. Some white towels, too. Leave your laundry upstairs and I'll take care of it."
"Thank you, Sarah. That's one less risk of contagion to worry about."
Matthew selected one of the vials. "We'll start with the tetanus booster." Every time he stuck something in my arm, I winced. By the 3rd shot, there was a thin sheen of sweat on my forehead and my heart was pounding.
"Sarah," I said faintly, "can you please not stand behind me?"
"Sorry." Sarah moved to stand behind Matthew instead. "I'll get you some water." She handed me a glass of ice-cold water, the outside slippery with condensation. I took it gratefully, trying to focus on holding it steady rather than on the next vial Matthew was opening. Another needle entered my skin and I jumped.
"That's the last shot," Matthew said.
He opened the container that looked like it was filled with salt crystals and carefully added the contents to a bottle of liquid. After giving it a vigorous shake, he handed it to me.
"This is the cholera vaccine. It's oral. Then there's the smallpox immunization and some pills to take after dinner for the next few nights."
I drank it down quickly, but still almost gagged at the thick texture and vile taste. Matthew opened up the sealed pouch, holding the 2-pronged smallpox inoculator.
"Do you know what Thomas Jefferson wrote to Edward Jenner about this vaccine?" he asked, voice hypnotic. "Jefferson said it was medicine's most useful discovery."
There was a cold touch of alcohol on my right arm, then pricks as the inoculator's prongs pierced the skin.
"The president dismissed Harvey's discovery of the circulation of blood as nothing more than a beautiful addition to medical knowledge."
Matthew moved in a circular pattern, distributing the live virus on my skin.
His diversionary tactics were working. I was too busy listening to his story to pay much attention to my arm.
"But Jefferson praised Jenner, because his inoculation relegated smallpox to a disease that would be known only to historians. He'd saved the human race from one of its most deadly enemies."
Matthew dumped the empty vial and the inoculator into a sealed biohazard container.
"Hold on. Did you know Jefferson?"
I was already fantasizing about time-walking to 18th-century Virginia. "I knew Washington better. He was a soldier, a man who let his actions speak for him. Jefferson was full of words. But it wasn't easy to reach the man behind the intellect. I'd never drop by his house unannounced, with a blue stocking like you in tow."
I reached for my turtleneck, but Matthew stilled my arm and carefully covered the inoculation site with a waterproof bandage. This is a live virus, so you have to keep it covered. Sophie and Nathaniel can't come into contact with it, or with anything that touches it. He moved to the sink and vigorously washed his hands in steaming hot water. For how long? It will form a blister, and then the blister will scab over. No one should touch the site until the blister heals. I pulled the old stretched-out turtleneck over my head, taking care not to dislodge the bandage. Now that that's done, we need to figure out how Diana is going to carry you and herself to some distant time by Halloween. She may have been time-walking since she was an infant, but it's still not easy, Sarah worried, her face twisted in a frown. Em appeared around the door. We made room for her at the table. I've been time-walking recently, too, I confessed. When? Matthew paused for a moment in his work of clearing up what remained of the inoculations. First, on the driveway when you were talking to Isabeau, then again the day Sarah was trying to make me light a candle when I went from the still room to the orchard. Both times I picked up my foot, wished myself somewhere else, and put my foot down where I wanted to be. That sounds like time walking, Sarah said slowly. Of course you didn't travel far, and you weren't carrying anything. She sized up Matthew, her expression turning doubtful. There was a knock at the door.
Can I come in?
Sophie's call was muffled.
Can she, Matthew? Em asked.
As long as she doesn't touch Diana.
When Em opened the door, Sophie was moving soothing hands around her belly. Everything's going to be all right, she said serenely from the threshold. As long as Matthew has a connection to the place they're going, he'll help Diana, not weigh her down.
Miriam appeared behind Sophie.
Is something interesting happening?
We're talking about time walking, I said.
How will you practice?
Miriam stepped around Sophie and pushed her firmly back toward the door when she tried to follow. Diana will go back in time a few hours, then a few more. We'll increase the time involved, then the distance. Then we'll add Matthew and see what happens. Sarah looked at Em. Can you help her?
A bit, Em replied cautiously. Stephen told me how he did it. He never used spells to go back in time. His power was strong enough without them. Given Diana's early experiences with time-walking and her difficulties with witchcraft, we might want to follow his example.
Why don't you and Diana go to the barn and try? Sarah suggested gently. She can come straight back to the still room. When Matthew started after us, Sarah put a hand out and stopped him. Stay here. Matthew's face had gone gray again. He didn't like me in a different room, never mind a different time.
The hop barn still held the sweet aroma of long-ago harvests.
Em stood opposite and quietly issued instructions.
Stand as still as possible, she said, and empty your mind.
You sound like my yoga teacher, I said, arranging my limbs in the familiar lines of mountain pose. Em smiled.
I've always thought yoga and magic had a lot in common. Now close your eyes. Think about the still room you just left. You have to want to be there more than here. Recreating the still room in my mind, I furnished it with objects, scents, people.
I frowned.
Where will you be?
It depends on when you arrive. If it's before we left, I'll be there. If not, I'll be here.
The physics of this don't make sense.
My head filled with concerns about how the universe would handle multiple Dianas and M's, not to mention Miriam's and Sarah's.
Stop thinking about physics. What did your dad write in his note? Whoever can no longer wonder, no longer marvel, is as good as dead.
Close enough, I admitted reluctantly.
It's time for you to take a big step into the mysterious, Diana. The magic and wonder that was always your birthright is waiting for you. Now think about where you want to be. When my mind was brimming over with images of it, I picked up my foot. When I put it down again, there I was in the hop barn with Em.
It didn't work, I said, panicking.
You were too focused on the details of the room. Think about Matthew. Don't you want to be with him? Magic's in the heart, not the mind. It's not about words and following a procedure like witchcraft. You have to feel it.
Desire.
I saw myself calling notes and queries from the shelf at the Bodleian, felt once more the first touch of Matthew's lips on mine in his room at All Souls. The barn dropped away, and Matthew was telling me the story about Thomas Jefferson and Edward Jenner.
No,
Em said, her voice steely. Don't think about Jefferson, think about Matthew.
Matthew.
I brought my mind back to the touch of his cool fingers against my skin, the rich sound of his voice, the sense of intense vitality when we were together. I picked up my foot. It landed in the corner of the still room, where I was squashed behind an old barrel. What if she gets lost? Matthew sounded tense. How will we get her back?
We don't have to worry about that, Sophie said, pointing in my direction. She's already here.
Matthew whipped around and let out a ragged breath. How long have I been gone? I felt lightheaded and disoriented, but otherwise fine.
About 90 seconds, Sarah said. More than enough time for Matthew to have a nervous breakdown.
Matthew pulled me into his arms and tucked me under his chin.
Thank God. How soon can she take me with her? Let's not get ahead of ourselves, Sarah warned. One step at a time.
I looked around. Where's Em?
In the barn.
Sophie was beaming.
She'll catch up.
It took more than 20 minutes for Em to return. When she did, her cheeks were pink from concern as well as the cold, though some of the tension left her when she saw me standing with Matthew.
You did good, Em, Sarah said, kissing her in a rare public display of affection.
Diana started thinking about Thomas Jefferson, Em said. She might have ended up at Monticello. Then she focused on her feelings, and her body got blurry around the edges. I blinked, and she was gone. That afternoon, with Em's careful coaching, I took a slightly longer trip back to breakfast. Over the next few days, I went a bit farther with each time walk. Going back in time, aided by three objects, was always easier than returning to the present, which required enormous concentration as well as an ability to accurately forecast where and when you wanted to arrive. Finally, it was time to try carrying Matthew. Sarah had insisted on limiting the variables to accommodate the extra effort required. "Start out wherever you want to end up," she advised. "That way, all you have to worry about is thinking yourself back to a particular time. The place will take care of itself." I took him up to the bedroom at twilight, without telling him what was in store. The figure of Diana and the golden earring from Bridget Bishop's puppet were sitting on the chest of drawers in front of a photograph of my parents.
"Much as I'd like to spend a few hours with you in here, alone. Dinner is almost ready," he protested, though there was a calculating gleam in his eyes.
"There's plenty of time. Sarah said I'm ready to take you time walking. We're going back to our first night in the house." Matthew thought for a moment, and his eyes brightened further. "Was that the night the stars came out? Inside?" I kissed him in answer.
"Oh."
He looked shyly pleased.
"What should I do?"
"Nothing." This would be the hardest thing about time walking for him.
"What are you always telling me? Close your eyes, relax, and let me do the rest?"
I grinned wickedly. He laced his fingers through mine. "Which?" "You won't even know it's happening," I assured him. "It's fast. Just pick up your foot and put it down again when I tell you, and don't let go."
"Not a chance," Matthew said, tightening his grip.
I thought about that night, our first alone after my encounter with Satu. I remembered his touch against my back, fierce and gentle at the same time. I felt the connection, immediate and tenacious, to that shared moment in our past. "Now," I whispered. Our feet rose together. But time walking with Matthew was different. Having him along slowed us down, and for the first time, I was aware of what was happening. The past, present, and future shimmered around us in a spider web of light and color. Each strand in the web moved slowly, almost imperceptibly, sometimes touching another filament before moving gently away again as if caught by a breeze. Each time strands touched, and millions of strands were touching all the time, there was the soft echo of an original, inaudible sound. Momentarily distracted by the seemingly limitless possibilities before us, we found it easy to lose sight of the twisted red and white strand of time we were following. I brought my concentration back to it, knowing it would take us back to our first night in Madison. I put my foot down and felt rough floorboards against my bare skin.
"You told me it would be fast," he said hoarsely. "That didn't feel fast to me."
"No, it was different," I agreed. "Did you see the lights?"
Matthew shook his head. "There was nothing but blackness. I was falling slowly, with only your hand keeping me from hitting bottom. He raised it to his mouth and kissed it. There was a lingering smell of chili in the quiet house, and it was night outside. Can you tell who's here? His nostrils flared and he closed his eyes. Then he smiled and sighed with happiness. Just Sarah and Em and you and me. None of the children. I giggled, drawing him closer. If this house gets any more crowded, it's going to burst. Matthew buried his face in my neck, then drew back. You still have your bandage. It means that when we go back in time, we don't stop being who we are in the present or forget what's happened to us here. His cold hands crept under the hem of my turtleneck. Given your rediscovered talents as a time walker, how accurate are you at gauging the passage of time? Though we happily lingered in the past, we were back in the present before Emily finished making the salad. Time walking agrees with you, Matthew, Sarah said, scrutinizing his relaxed face. She rewarded him with a glass of red wine. Thank you, Sarah. I was in good hands. He raised his glass to me in salute. Glad to hear it, Sarah said dryly, sounding like my ghostly grandmother. She threw some sliced radishes into the biggest salad bowl I'd ever seen. Where did that come from? I peered into the bowl to hide my reddened lips. The house, Em said, beating the salad dressing with a whisk. It enjoys having so many mouths to feed. Next morning, the house let us know it was anticipating yet another addition. Sarah, Matthew, and I were discussing whether my next time walk should be to Oxford or to Set Tour when Em appeared with a load of laundry in her arms. Somebody is coming. Matthew put down his paper and stood. Good. I was expecting a delivery today. It's not a delivery and they're not here yet, but the house is ready for them. She disappeared into the laundry room. Another room? Where did the house put this one? Sarah shouted after her. Next to Marcus. Em's reply echoed from the depths of the washing machine. We took bets on who it would be. The guesses ranged from Agatha Wilson to Emily's friends from Cherry Valley, who liked to show up unannounced for the Covens' Halloween party. Late in the morning, there was an authoritative knock on the door. It opened to a small, dark man with intelligent eyes. He was instantly recognizable, from pictures taken at celebrity parties in London and television news conferences. Any remaining doubts about his identity were erased by the familiar nudges against my cheekbones. Our mystery house guest was Matthew's friend, Hamish Osborne. "You must be Diana," he said without pleasure or preamble, his Scottish accent lending length to the vowels. Hamish was dressed for business, in a pinstriped charcoal suit that had been tailored to fit him exactly, a pale pink shirt with heavy silver cufflinks, and a fuchsia tie embroidered with tiny black flies. "I am. Hello, Hamish. Was Matthew expecting you?" I stepped aside to let him in. "Probably not," Hamish said crisply, remaining on the stoop. "Where is he?" "Hamish." Matthew was moving so quickly I felt the breeze behind me before hearing him approach. He extended his hand. "This is a surprise." Hamish stared at the outstretched hand, then turned his eyes to its owner. "Surprise? Let's discuss surprises. When I joined your family farm, you swore to me this would never arrive." He brandished an envelope, its black seal broken but still clinging to the flaps. "I did." Matthew dropped his hand and looked at Hamish warily. "So much for your promises, then. I'm given to understand from this letter and from my conversation with your mother that there's some kind of trouble." Hamish's eyes flickered to me, then back to Matthew. "Yes." Matthew's lips tightened. "But you're the ninth knight. You don't have to become involved."
"You made a demon the ninth knight."
Miriam had come through the dining room with Nathaniel.
"Who's he?"
Nathaniel shook a handful of Scrabble tiles in his cupped hand while surveying the new arrival.
"Hamish Osborne. And who might you be?"
Hamish asked, as if addressing an impertinent employee. The last thing we needed was more testosterone in the house.
"Oh, I'm nobody," Nathaniel said airily, leaning against the dining room door.
He watched Marcus as he passed by.
"Hamish, why are you here?"
Marcus looked confused, then saw the letter. "Oh." My ancestors were congregating in the keeping room, and the house was stirring on its foundations. Could we continue this inside?
It's the house, you see. It's a little uneasy, given you're a demon, and angry. Come, Hamish. Matthew tried to draw him out of the doorway. Marcus and Sarah haven't demolished the whiskey supply yet. We'll get you a drink and sit you by the fire. Hamish remained where he was and kept talking.
While visiting with your mother, who is far more willing to answer my questions than you would have been, I learned that you wanted a few things from home. It seemed a shame for a land to make such a long trip, when I was already going to come and ask you what the hell you were up to.
He lifted a bulky leather briefcase with soft sides and a formidable lock, and a smaller, hard-sided case.
Thank you, Hamish. The words were cordial enough, but Matthew was clearly displeased at having his arrangements altered.
Speaking of explanations, it's a damn good thing the French don't care about the exportation of English national treasures. Have you any idea of the paperwork that would have been required to get this out of England, if they'd let me remove it at all, which I doubt?
Matthew took the briefcase from Hamish's fingers, gripped him by the elbow, and pulled his friend inside. Later, he said hastily. Marcus, take Hamish and introduce him to Diana's family while I put these away.
Oh, it's you, said Sophie with delight, coming out of the dining room.
The bulge of her belly showed plainly underneath a stretched University of North Carolina sweatshirt.
You're like Nathaniel, not scatterbrained like me. Your face is on one of my pots, too.
She beamed at Hamish, who looked both charmed and startled. Are there more? He asked me with a cock of his head that made him resemble a tiny, bright-eyed bird.
Many more, Sophie replied happily. You won't see them, though.
Come and meet my aunts, I said hastily. The witches. It was impossible to know what Hamish was thinking. His sharp eyes missed nothing, and his face was nearly as impassive as Matthew's. Yes, the witches. Matthew disappeared upstairs while Marcus and I introduced Hamish to Em. He seemed less annoyed with her than he was with Matthew and me, and she immediately started fussing over him. Sarah met us at the stillroom door, wondering what the commotion was about.
"We're a proper conventicle now, Sarah," Sophie observed, as she reached for the pyramid of freshly baked cookies on the kitchen island. "All nine. 3 witches, 3 demons, and 3 vampires, present and accounted for."
"Looks like it," Sarah agreed, sizing up Hamish. She watched her partner buzzing around the kitchen like a bewildered bee. "Em, I don't think our new guest needs tea or coffee. Is the whiskey in the dining room?"
Diana and I call it the war room, Sophie confided, grabbing Hamish familiarly by the forearm. Though it seems unlikely we could fight a war without the humans finding out. It's the only place big enough to hold us now. Some of the ghosts managed to squeeze in, too.
Ghosts? Hamish reached up and loosened his tie. The dining room. Sarah gripped Hamish's other elbow. Everybody in the dining room. Matthew was already there. The aroma of hot wax filled the air. When all of us had grabbed our chosen drink and found a seat, he took charge. Hamish has questions, Matthew said. Nathaniel and Sophie, too. And I suppose this is my tale to tell. Mine and Diana's. With that, Matthew took a deep breath and plunged in. He included everything. Ashmole 782, the Knights of Lazarus, the break-ins at Oxford, Satu and what happened at La Pierre, even Baldwin's Fury. There were puppets and earrings and face jugs as well. Hamish looked at Matthew sharply when he discussed time-walking and the 3 objects I would need to travel back to a particular time and place.
"Matthew Claremont," Hamish hissed, leaning across the table. "Is that what I brought from Septour? Does Diana know?"
"No," Matthew confessed, looking slightly uncomfortable. "She'll know on Halloween."
"Well, she'll have to know on Halloween, wouldn't she?"
Hamish let out an exasperated sigh.
Though the exchange between Hamish and Matthew was heated, there were only 2 moments when the tension threatened to escalate into outright civil war. Both of them, not surprisingly, involved Matthew and Nathaniel.
The first was when Matthew explained to Sophie what this war would be like. The unexpected attacks, the long simmering feuds between vampires and witches that would come to a boil, the brutal deaths that were bound to occur as creature fought creature, using magic, witchcraft, brute strength, speed, and preternatural cunning.
"That's not how wars are fought anymore," Nathaniel's deep voice cut through the resulting chatter.
Matthew's eyebrow floated up, and his face took on an impatient expression. "No?"
Wars are fought on computers. This isn't the 13th century. Hand-to-hand combat isn't required.
He gestured at his laptop on the sideboard. With computers, you can take down your enemy without ever firing a shot or shedding a drop of blood.
This may not be the 13th century, Nathaniel, but some of the combatants will have lived through those times, and they have a sentimental attachment to destroying people the old-fashioned way. Leave this to me and Marcus.
Matthew thought this was the end of the matter.
Nathaniel shook his head and stared fixedly at the table.
"Do you have something else to say?"
Matthew asked, an ominous purring starting in the back of his throat.
"You've made it perfectly clear you'll do whatever you want in any case."
Nathaniel lifted his frank brown eyes in challenge, then shrugged.
"Suit yourself, but you're making a mistake if you think your enemies won't use more modern methods to destroy you. There are humans to consider, after all. They'll notice if vampires and witches start fighting one another in the street.